From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 20th day of May, 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. A bit later in the program today, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Lafayette, Indiana. He and Dan Zwicker are swapping places this week. We'll talk with Dan tomorrow. A bit later in this program today, your director of ag programming will be here. His name, of course, is Dave Dickey. He'll have all the agricultural news for the day. And then in the second half hour of the program, we call that The Farming World, shows up on many of these radio stations and always online at willag.org. We'll talk with two folks. In the first part of the program, Phil Tsang of the U.S. Meat Export Federation about food insecurity issues. And in the second part of the program, Dwayne Frederking of Pioneer will be here. We'll talk about replanting soybeans and seed treatments there, along with fungicide applications for corn with Mr. Frederking from Pioneer. Hey, don't forget, as we close out our half hour for the Closing Market Report in just about 26 minutes, Pete Levitt will be here to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
The Closing Market Report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from L&M Commodities, a full-service brokerage company serving area farmers with professional market advice and crop insurance products. L&M Commodities has offices in New Market, Indiana, Leland, Illinois, and Terrell, Arkansas.
In Chicago, on this Thursday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The nearby July wheat at $4.69¾, up a half today. September at $4.86¾, unchanged. December at $5.17 a bushel, unchanged there as well. July hard red, the harvest month in Kansas City at $4.92½, up a penny for the day. July corn futures, $3.62 in Chicago, up $2¾. September, $3.69½, a penny and a half higher. And December contract at $3.78½, up a half. March futures, $3.90¾, up a quarter of a cent. May contract of next year unchanged at $3.99. Soy complex now, July beans, $9.44, up 5½. The August at $9.35, 4½ higher. September at $9.17, up 4½. And the November futures harvest month at $9.08, up 2¼ cents. January futures, $9.17, up 2 for the day. July bean meal at $2.76.20, up $2.80. July soybean oil, $37.39, down 11. June live cattle futures, $91.45, 97½ cents lower. May feeders at $108.80, down $1.55 on the afternoon. And the June lean hogs, $80.25 a hundredweight, down $1.77½ on this Thursday afternoon. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. June crude oil futures, $68 and a penny, down $1.86 a barrel. June ethanol at $1.58, down 2½ cents. Natural gas at $4.12¼ a cent, down 3½ cents. And heating oil at $1.89¼, down 4⅙ cents on the afternoon. Gold futures are down $4.80 at $1,187.80 an ounce. That's a settlement price in the Dow now, just about 195 points lower at 10,248 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like for the day. It says some showers, a few isolated thunderstorms will return to the two-state area. That'll bring further delays, of course, to the planting and field work, especially in southern areas where heavy rain is likely through Saturday morning. Northern Illinois will see the lightest rain with less than a half inch in most locations over the next 36 hours. Then a major warm-up will usher in the first round of summer-like temperatures since mid-April and help development and emergence rates. Soybean planting, corn replanting, soybean replanting as well will become more active after the delays caused by rain over the next 2 days. Flooding will be confined to the river and drainage basins, although some fields will remain too wet for much activity for several days. We'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast at the bottom of this half hour when we talk with Pete Levitt, agricultural meteorologist. He joins us from his offices in Boston, Massachusetts.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Thursday afternoon. On the line with us today, Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Lafayette, Indiana. He and Dan Zwicker are trading days this week, so we'll talk with Dan tomorrow. Mike, it's good to have you on a Thursday.
Nice to be with you, Todd. Nice not to close out a week for a change.
Well, there you go. That means you get to predict tomorrow.
Oh, good. Thanks a lot.
Isn't that nice? All
That's
right.
Why you have Dan on Thursday.
Yeah, so he could predict tomorrow. Okay. You know, one of the things I was making note of, and I'm sure you followed along with this as well, is the November beans down in the $8 range, $8.94 for a low today. What does that mean to you, to the marketplace, when we break the $9 level?
Well, we didn't on a close, and it means a lot. I've called this 905 low that we've been able to stay above since February 5th on a closing basis, a Custer line, because it's kind of a last stand for beans in my mind, Todd. So between that and the fact that the July pulled the November back up, and the July NOVE spread was able to get up to 36 cents in terms of an inversion of 36 cents, the best close we've seen since the end of March, I think that says a lot as well. And I don't know if it's so much the issue of the Chinese reportedly switching up to 5 cargoes from South America to U.S. destination or origin as far as the why the market wanted to keep that spread going so strong today, and for the most part, you know, so far all this week, or whether it's just a big question mark out there of how good the crushing margins are, but yet beans seem to be very, very hard to find. And certainly the last couple weeks when I've talked to clients about how much 09 beans they may have, especially before this break we had, very few of them have much more than 5 or 10% of their 09 beans left on farm and storage. So I got to think that maybe this spread is coming back around and favoring the bull side because of not China, but more because there's just not a lot of beans to grab out there between now and our harvest here domestically.
Yeah, so there are two things at work. General Custer didn't fare very well, by the way.
Oh, that's right.
But there are two things at work. So we have a large crop out of South America. What probably will be a big crop in the United States under normal growing conditions, of course. And then there's a fairly decent-sized carryover in the U.S., but it may already be worked into the hands of the end users. It's hard to say whether that's the case. There's certainly not many beans out there. So you're suggesting that we could have a bullish front end of the marketplace, but will that be enough to hold up the back end?
Well, historically it does, because when you have that inversion, it says that demand is greatest in the front end, and that's typically a sign of a demand bull market. I think the one thing that I go back to was the USDA report when they did not change the 09 bean carryover from 190. I know a lot of people that I talk to in Chicago, and I myself with the 09 ending stocks figures are closer to a 170 level, just because we feel like that maybe the demand base, along with a little bit less yield, would say there's maybe 15 to 20 million bushels less out there of 09 crop. And so I think that maybe is working into the mindset of the trade once again. The other thing goes back to certainly a lot of what's been happening in the beans has been currency related, because the November beans, July beans, no matter what contract you're talking about, tend to follow in sympathy the Brazilian real. So when the dollar's sharply higher, the real's lower, beans tend to go down in Chicago, because it improves the purchasing power of their selling power of the Brazilians, and they need to break their price. Our prices need to break back down. But what we've seen also with the dollar strengthening so much is the Chinese buying power, because they're kind of a de facto hook to the U.S. dollar in terms of their yuan. Their buying power has essentially gone up. So maybe, just maybe, their demand base is not eroding here because the dollar has been going higher. Maybe it won't be U.S. beans so much that they buy, but their overall demand will continue to go up. I know Cargill had some expectations for the corn and bean expectations for 2010-2011 that were published on Bloomberg earlier today, and they're still looking at between 5 and 8% increases year over year in the next couple, 3 years. So certainly that would add to the idea that China's going to continue to buy.
All right, and then what do you see in the corn market?
Well, we continue to see the corn try and find bargain hunting, because China is still in the news. interesting thing that's happened maybe from last week when you and I talked to right now is that the traders are a lot less skeptical that China will continue to buy. In other words, the production number for last year in China seems to have dropped down by some of the contacts I have in Chicago, and maybe that adds to the idea that they're going to keep buying corn for a longer period of time. And certainly COFCO coming in and buying more reportedly today and them coming up against their import license limit certainly adds to that mindset as well. So corn seems very, very well underpinned. And again, you saw the July corn lead the December up. Again, that would be a demand bias in the market and the spreads. And here again, I've got clients over all the way over in Greenville, Ohio, getting five over at ethanol plants. I think Claypool in northern Indiana is 10 or 15 over for spot corn right now. It seems like the cash corn, the cash beans are really adding a lot to the and underpinning these markets right now. They're kind of the real economy as opposed to what's going on in the financial markets.
I wonder about this Chinese crop from last year and how that number could have been missed and by how much it might have been missed. I know stats aren't awfully good coming out of China, but you would think that they're a lot better with American companies there servicing the needs of the Chinese farmer, of course.
Right.
And they are. Surely that number is better than and more reliable than what it appears to be at this point, and there's something else happening in that marketplace.
Well, yeah, indeed. I think that their numbers are improving. I think that can be, you know, conclusively seen in how they measure and how much more frequency they measure. I guess with China, it's kind of similar to what we talk about here in the United States. Just a minute yield change can shave off quite a bit of bushels, and I think you combine the 09 crop with their continued weather problems for the 2010 crop. They haven't gotten their northern China plain straightened out, and planting has not gotten straightened out at all. I just got an email alert from another news source in China that remarks that if they're in the central and southwest parts of China, if the rains don't come in that area, especially Hunan province, especially because it's such a densely populated area, they don't see rains by the late May time period. They're talking about consequences on their people in terms of lack of water and how much crops they're going to lose as quote, unthinkable, and that came from a fairly reliable source. So I think there's still the idea that as their weather continues to degradate in the northern plain and it doesn't improve in the southwest region, that's going to add to their price, and we just hit add to their demand, and their prices just hit another high on the Dalian exchange last night, I believe. I think they got up to around 7.34 a bushel.
So their marketplace is high, and it's just easier to get it out of the United States and other places then.
These imports are not bringing their prices down. These auctions
right.
domestically are not bringing their prices down. That's what I read into it. You really can't read too much else into it unless you've got contacts directly over there, which I know that's getting better and better, but not very many people want to go out on the line if you talk to them domestically in terms of if you talk to them and you want to carry that information back. They don't tell them I said this, you know, that type of thing, but what you can read into this is that the domestic auctions and the imports that they've gotten so far, it's not cooling their prices, and that's really all I care about right now.
And what does it mean? You mean you're going to hang on to old crop corn and
exactly.
not make new crop sales?
Cash is king right now. You know, you hear that a lot when you have a recession, you have high interest rates, you have inflation coming, cash is king. I think cash corn, cash beans are king right now, especially the cash corn, because that demand curve seems to be curling up in terms of our prospects for more corn purchases from China.
And if you do that, how much do you fear June, July, and August?
Well, I've been running with the mindset, as you know, I've been running with the mindset that we would have a May-June low because this market seems fairly similar to 1980 and that we would have a May-June low in the new crop and then we'd try and find a bottom in the June-July time frame. Next week will tell us a lot in terms of weather. If we really do straighten out like you talked about before I came on the air, if we do straighten out, then maybe we continue to, you know, stay sideways to lower. But if that weather doesn't pan out so good, I think we can get a May low here.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd. Have a great weekend.
Hey, you too. Mike Zuzulo is with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. He's in Lafayette, Indiana.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Dave Dickey is here now with the agricultural news for the afternoon.
In agricultural news, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he and his fellow Democrats plan to spend at least 1 week in June focusing on nothing but pending energy and climate legislation in hopes of getting a consensus on how to proceed on a bill that faces an increasingly uncertain outlook this year. Reid says he will meet with the six Senate chairmen with jurisdiction over the climate measure the week of June 7th. Reid adds, quote, "Then the following week, I hope to have a full caucus where we will just talk about nothing but energy." The Food and Drug Administration says it may begin publicizing safety problems with the drugs it rejects under a sweeping proposal to bring greater transparency to an agency that regulates everything from pacemakers to peanut butter. A report from the agency suggests 21 ways the FDA could release more information to the public in areas like drug evaluation and food manufacturing inspections. U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner will tell Chinese counterparts next week that the U.S. intends to get its deficits down, but only after recovery is fully established. Geithner will be participating in meetings of the Strategic and Economic Dialogue in Beijing on Monday and Tuesday. Senior Treasury officials also say that the U.S. will continue nudging China to let its yuan currency appreciate, but won't push hard on the issue. Global agribusiness and food company Bunge Limited is gauging investor interest for the launch of an investment fund that would buy land in Brazil to take advantage of demand for sugar and sugar-based ethanol. The offering would build on Bunge's expanding presence in the sugar industry in Brazil. A key Arkansas farm leader says that Arkansas's agriculture community will support Senate Agriculture Committee Chairman Blanche Lincoln in her Democrat runoff election on June 8th. Ben Noble, executive director of the Arkansas Rice Federation, says the Arkansas agriculture establishment is, quote, "firmly in favor of Lincoln," and that rice, cotton, fish, and poultry leaders had sent out a letter supporting her last week. A new report released by the Renewable Fuels Association suggests the U.S. is evolving into a net exporter of ethanol. The Washington, D.C.-based group, which represents U.S. ethanol producers, said in the report, "The fact that U.S. ethanol exports are surging as domestic markets become saturated demonstrates that the American ethanol industry can and will compete globally." In March, the U.S. exported more than 45 million gallons of ethanol, and for the first quarter, U.S. exports exceeded 83 million gallons. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Market Report and of Commodity Week and of the farming world. That's the second half of this program. Today we'll talk with Phil Tsang of the U.S. Meat Export Federation about food security issues. And we'll hear from Mr. Frederking, Dwayne Frederking, that is, from Pioneer. He'll take us through some, well, things that have to do with agronomy and in particular seed treatments for soybeans and fungicide applications for corn.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Up next in today's listener opinion forum, Shelby County Farm Bureau's Amy Rochkus says it's all about keeping the farm in the family.
For most farmers, providing the country's food, fiber, and fuel is not just about making a living. It's our way of life. a way of life we like to nurture, like our plants and animals, with the intention of passing it on to our children, grandchildren, and generations into the future. For some farm families, federal estate taxes can mean their most recent harvest was their last. Estate taxes owed to the federal government by the farm owner's surviving family members can hit farm families harder than other small business owners because 84% of our assets are real estate based. When Uncle Sam comes to pay his respects, surviving family members without enough cash on hand may be forced to sell land, buildings, or equipment that they need to keep their operations going. In these circumstances, farm families' heartache is felt well beyond the borders of our operations, as the rural communities and the businesses we support also suffer when farms downsize or disappear. And farmland close to urban centers is often lost forever to development when estate taxes force family farms to sell off land to pay the taxes. A higher exemption and lower rates will give farmers a better chance to remain in operation when transferring the farm from one generation to the next. This is why Farm Bureau is calling on Congress to provide a permanent estate tax provision that would increase the exemption level to $5 million with an adjustment for inflation and reduce the maximum rate to 35%. A vote for estate tax relief is not only a vote for grain and livestock farmers in Illinois, it's also one for the Chicago family sitting down to dinner tonight. This is Amy Rochkis with the Shelby County Farm Bureau.
Amy Rochkis' comments are her own. They reflect her opinions. They do not necessarily reflect those of this station. We strongly urge listeners like you to become involved by sharing your views as well. To do so, just give us a call. The number is 217-333-0850, or you can email us at willagstaff@illinois.edu. You know, I was thinking about this issue just last night as I sat at the table with Dad and the boys. That's what I call my four older brothers that farm. As you know, we were celebrating Dad's 84th birthday. Now, it struck me that it could be devastating to those four guys, all over 50 and in what should be their prime earning age, if when Dad passes, that they were subjected to a heavy estate tax. Those farms that Dad owns are already a big part of their yearly salaries. I'm not sure it's fair that we tax that entity, but what about my younger brother and me? Well, the two of us don't have that same vested interest, and maybe we should be taxed. I'd prefer that not be the case, so what if we try to learn something from President Lincoln and the Homestead Act? It allowed anybody to start farming 160 acres in the western frontier as long as they could put improvements on it and maintain it for 5 years. So how about something like this? No estate tax on farmland if it's actively farmed for 5 years. Active is the important part there because a crop share lease is considered active and means I, almost anyone if they hired a farm manager, hey, see that as job creation in rural America? Well, I could easily become an active participant in the farm. Really, isn't that what democracy is all about? Owning a vested interest in the nation? If I don't want to participate, then I pay the estate tax. It's about keeping people on the farm and in rural America. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. In just 2 minutes, we'll talk with agricultural meteorologist Pete Levitt.
It's National Quiche Lorraine Day. On this day in agricultural history, in 1862, President Abraham Lincoln signed the Homestead Act into law. It opened millions of acres of western land to settlers. The law allowed applicants freehold title to 160 acres of undeveloped land outside of the original 13 colonies. The new law required 3 steps, the filing of an application, improvement of the land, and filing for deed of title. Eventually, 1.6 million homesteads were granted, the last to Kenneth Deerdorf for a claim in Alaska. in 1988. In 1874, jeans with copper rivets are patented by Levi Strauss and Jacob Davis. For nearly 20 years, Levi Strauss & Company was the only company making riveted clothing until the patent expired around 1891. Thereafter, dozens of garment manufacturers began to imitate the original riveted clothing. In 1875, the International Bureau of Weights and Measures was created. In 1884, El Blue patented a hand corn sheller. And in 2005, Governor Jeb Bush signed a law making the orange the official state fruit of Florida. The orange blossom and orange juice were previously declared the official state flower and official state beverage. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. This afternoon, we're talking to Pete Leavitt about the agricultural weather forecast. He's on the line. Good afternoon to you, Pete.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Well, first, let's start with the forecast. Rain and then maybe warmer temperatures. Is that right?
That's it in a nutshell. We have a big band of rain from about I-74 now southward down toward the southern end of the state. It's swinging northeastward as the leading edge of some warmer air approaching, some more humid air approaching. And that rain will finish moving northward up past I-80 probably late this evening sometime, early tonight. And then we have an unsettled day tomorrow with some showers as a second system comes along from the west. But after that, we get one of these nice ridges of high pressure building that happens as we approach summer, and we're going to see temperatures getting well up in the 80s, I think, by Saturday, Sunday, right in through most of next week, we should see temperatures in the 80s. Some of the models are forecasting 90s, but I think the moisture in the soil may dampen and slow down that rise in temperatures a little bit. So upper 80s, maybe hitting 90 next week.
Yeah, well, that heat will be wanted, I think, by many across the Midwest in order to get the crops to jump up out of the ground.
Yes, they're emerging pretty well now. It's just in some of those colder spots, the northwestern portions of the Corn Belt have been cold and things are a little behind there, but it'll come along pretty quickly. And incidentally, early planting and the kind of temperatures we're looking for this season look like a favorable outlook for the crop.
Indeed. What's the extended forecast look like?
Yeah, the extended forecast comes out third Thursday, that's today, and from the National Weather Service. And we see for the month of June, temperatures below normal in the southeastern half of the Great Plains, about normal in the Midwest, above normal in the southwest, and precipitation above normal from Oklahoma northeastward to just about the Mississippi Valley along the Missouri-Illinois border. That's for June. For the summer, it's almost an ideal setup for crops for the summer. We have for June, July, and August, we have temperatures below normal. That's generally favorable for development. No drought stress or heat stress. And that below normal temperatures extend from the Rockies right across to the Ohio River Valley. Most of the central third of the country cooler than normal on the forecast. The heat is confined to the southwestern U.S. and the far southeastern U.S. And for precipitation, above normal precipitation from the northern plains down through most of the southern plains as far as northern central Texas. And eastward from there, precipitation is indeterminate, but my guess would be with all that wet weather just to the west of most of the Midwest, some of that moisture will find its way eastward as well.
Pete, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Pete Leavitt, agricultural meteorologist, joins us from his Boston, Massachusetts office. You're listening to the Course to the Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. Stay with us if you can for the afternoon. In the second half hour of our program on many of these stations, the farming world. If not, you can visit it online at willag.org. I'm Todd Gleason.
Is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
This is the Farming World News and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Phil Singh. He's the president and CEO of the U.S. Meat Export Federation, the second time in about a month, Mr. Singh, that we've had the opportunity to talk. Today our issues are surrounding food security. What does that phrase mean to you?
Well, I think that, again, if we take a look at this over the course of the last 25 or 30 years, in the past, many countries around the world, and we're speaking as far as red meat imports are concerned, were very obsessed about having self-sufficiency in food. And we saw many governments protect their markets. We had quotas. We had high tariffs. We had all kinds of border protection as countries tried to achieve what they would call self-sufficiency. On the other hand, which we've also seen in the course of the last 25 years, is a tremendous growth in consumption. We've seen the economic growth in Asia, in Latin America. We've seen tremendous economic growth actually in Russia, Europe, and around the world. And so what we have now is demand is actually outstripping supply in many respects. And I think this ushers in a whole new dynamic as far as the red meat complex and world trade.
And well, what kind of dynamic does that mean?
What we're seeing, and I think if you take a look at the last decade or the last two decades, you know, as we've had animal diseases, as we've seen, for example, the BSE that plagued Europe and then it's plagued other countries around the world. I think there's been 27 countries afflicted with BSE. As you take a look at last summer with the H1N1 issue, as you look at foot and mouth disease, has occurred in countries, especially in South America. As you look at politics, for example, what's impacted Argentina, which used to be probably one of the top three beef exporters in the world, now they're almost non-existent as far as exports. Their government policies have intervened. And so what happens is if you're a major country or a company, one of your major concerns is where are you going to procure your supply? And we see this, for example, in China, where they have a strategic reserve for pork, and they recognize if they're going to have stability in China, they must have available food, pork being a staple. There's a tremendous effort by the Chinese. We saw this in 2008, where when they had a disease problem, they had to resort to major imports. And this is all driven by the idea here that they need to have this food security. We see this also with other countries, both in the beef and the pork complex, where the demand is basically outstripping the supply. So in some instances, if you're a country like Japan, well over 50% of their total caloric intake is coming from imports. And so this means that they have to be very, very careful and also have to really provision for a stable supply coming in from foreign countries.
I'm not sure what all of that will mean in the long run. Does it mean that there should, in your opinion, I suppose, that there should be more interest in doing what China has done and putting back a reserve of some sort for pork? And also, does it also mean that the political barriers that sometime have been put up for trade, for instance, the disease barriers, might need to come down? And that would allow, you know, much more import into the United States as well.
Well, I think that obviously we as a net exporting nation would like to see, and we're a very strong advocate for the reduction of trade barriers and for unencumbered trade. I think what we're starting to see is that where these countries, and there's really two kinds of countries in the world, there are the net importers and the net exporters. And the net importers, we are starting to see this border protection gradually recede. It's not as fast as we would like it, but we're starting to see it recede. And where I'm coming from this primarily, is as you talk to, for example, companies like McDonald's, if you talk to Tesco out of the UK, Walmart, Carrefour out of France, or Metro out of Germany, these are major worldwide conglomerates. And they are very concerned about procuring and maintaining a stable supply of beef and pork. And we're seeing this as animal disease and these other things affect us. So it's not only at the country level, but it's also at the corporate level that supply becomes a very important factor in their plans going forward. And this is going to make some things differently. I firmly believe that in the 70s, if we can remember, there was these LTAs that we used to sign with Russia, where we would have these long-term trade agreements with Russia to provide certain amounts of corn, soybeans, grain to the Russians. There is a possibility that certain countries or certain companies will probably go along that same route. And that means major suppliers like the United States or some of our major competitors, I think, would look at this. So I see our U.S. agricultural policy, and I see the way that we deal with some of these important trading partners, especially some of the net importers. I think we need to have a different posture and look at this from the standpoint of how we can build bridges, how we can work to assure certain countries that the United States will be a reliable supplier. And this is a very important factor for a lot of countries and also for companies, but it is a new approach, frankly. But it's something that we need to really do to reassure our valued buyers in a lot of these countries about our supply.
Can we take up just a bit those companies out of Europe and the European Union, Carrefour in France, Tesco in England, and Germany's Metro? Those companies have long in their areas been big fans, and I think probably for a couple of reasons, of making sure that all the products that come into their stores are ID'd in some form, so that if you go to Carrefour in France, they really want their meat products to say they were raised and produced in France. The same goes for Tesco in England and I think probably in Germany as well. This would be a very big change for them in the way that they are procuring, in this case, meat. Do you really think that's happening with them, or will they want that national ID to stay, or that country of origin to stay with the meat products?
Well, I think that we have to recognize that Carrefour, all of those companies, for example, Metro, Tesco, they operate in the EU, but they also operate outside of the EU. And we've seen production in the EU actually decline quite dramatically. The EU now is a major importer of beef. I think when we take a look at the EU, the amount that they bring in right now is close to 400,000 metric tons they're importing. There's been a sea shift. And so the EU imposes certain requirements that you have to have in order to access the EU. And, of course, traceability, that ID is very important. It's a critical factor. But in some of the other markets that they operate in, those are not factors. So what we see is that these are major challenges for them, both within the EU, and that's changing. I don't see that because of the EU consumers, they're going to change when it comes to these issues. So if we want to access these markets, I think we have to listen to the customer, be aware of the realities of dealing in those markets, and then we have to adjust accordingly to move forward. But if we make those changes, if we do these things, I think it's going to allow us to be successful in many areas. I've often looked at marketing, and I've been doing this for 35 years. I've looked at marketing as simply as you identify what are these customer needs. You find out some of the most stringent requirements that you have. If you can have the industry adjust some of those requirements, then you're going to be able to access almost any other market around the world because you've done this. And so I will admit some countries that there might be some excess when it comes to these things. And of course, we work and our government works to eradicate things that we think would be superfluous, if you will. But for the most part, we've been very successful internationally because we've been adaptable. Our suppliers, our major exporters, have been adaptable and been able to adapt to these changing needs. And we're seeing this really accelerate, I think, in this last decade.
So at this point, it appears that the food distribution system has gotten to the point and that it's good enough to ship product all around the world and to do that successfully, and that the need in parts of the world for red meats is greater than what they might be able to produce in their own areas. What are the pitfalls of putting that kind of distribution system really into play?
Well, I think that, again, when I talk about some of the major strides that we've made, one of the key things that we have done was actually capitalize on the technology to ship chilled product around the world. Today, the pork that we ship to Japan, probably almost 70% of the pork that we, I think it's 72% of the pork we ship to Japan today is in a chilled state. This makes us very competitive, not only with our competition. For example, the Europeans going to Japan still can only ship it frozen because of the distance in shipping it. We have a 10 days or 12 days, basically, shipping time on the water. And so this is really down to a science. We've worked with Iowa State University, we've worked with Illinois, University of Illinois, and we've worked to actually develop chilled technology to the packaging, so we have very low plate counts. And so when our product, for example, our pork in Japan today is in the same state as the Japanese pork would be, the domestically produced pork. And so this gives us a tremendous competitive edge. So it's some of these technological things that we can do that will really help us be successful. And so I would say in the last few years, the U.S. packers, the exporters, they've done a tremendous job. And I think this is where when we look at the commitment of the industry, there's a tremendous amount of commitment by the producers, by grain producers, soybean producers, oil seeds, corn. They've all gotten behind this. It's not just pork producers or beef producers that contribute to this. It's the whole fabric of U.S. agriculture. Looking at the international marketplace as a tremendous avenue for growth. I mean, a lot of people do not realize that 25% of the pork produced in the United States is exported. And it's over 10% of the beef that we produce in the United States is exported. So it's very central to the profitability of the U.S. supplier in our country.
Can you tell me a bit more about this chilled technology? So when pork arrives in Japan, it arrives cold, fresh, not frozen, right?
No, it's not frozen. We are the major inroads that we've had, for example, in Japan, has been able to sell our chilled pork, and it goes right into the retail trade, and it's been very successful. And we're doing the same thing now in Korea. And these are things that we can do that give us a leg up, if you will, on a lot of our competitors. Now, of course, Canada is very competitive in the chilled area as well, because as you go to Japan, from Vancouver, for example, it's even closer going over the North Pacific as it would be going from some of our ports like Los Angeles or Seattle or San Francisco, or Long Beach. But we do have a decided advantage over a lot of our European suppliers, over South American suppliers, for example, like Chile. It's very difficult for them to do the chilled product because of the distances and the time.
So we're capable of shipping all around the world. We've got the distribution system that is technologically advancing. What does it have to do then with self-sufficiency or the ability of people to feed themselves and food security?
Well, I think the key thing about this whole thing is that we can put product into their countries very similar to what their domestically produced product would have been like. And so as we ship the chilled product, we see the yields for this product, the color. We see the product is in a more wholesome state than maybe some of the frozen product. It's preferred by a lot of users, and also it gives us a competitive edge. So this is very important for us as we try to gain more access into these markets and be more successful in marketing. We have to use every tool available to us and avail ourselves to every tool in order to be competitive. I think a lot of people in this country would look at the U.S. market, and if they walk into a store, they would see only American pork or only American beef. But if you go to Japan, there's over 20 countries trying to supply beef to Japan or supply pork to Japan, and this makes for a very competitive atmosphere. So the kinds of programs, the things we have to do, it's a much different dynamic than what you have in the United States.
Mr. Tsang, thank you so much for joining us again. Look forward to talking to you in the future.
You bet.
That's Phil Tsang. He's the president and CEO of the U.S. Meat Export Federation.
It's National Quiche Lorraine Day. On this day in agricultural history, in 1862, President Abraham Lincoln signed the Homestead Act into law. It opened millions of acres of western land to settlers. The law allowed applicants freehold title to 160 acres of undeveloped land outside of the original 13 colonies. The new law required three steps: the filing of an application, improvement of the land, and filing for deed of title. Eventually, 1.6 million homesteads were granted, the last to Kenneth Deerdorf for a claim in Alaska in 1988. In 1874, jeans with copper rivets are patented by Levi Strauss and Jacob Davis. For nearly 20 years, Levi Strauss & Company was the only company making riveted clothing until the patent expired around 1891. Thereafter, dozens of garment manufacturers began to imitate the original riveted clothing. In 1875, the International Bureau of Weights and Measures was created. In 1884, El Blue patented a hand corn sheller. And in 2005, Governor Jeb Bush signed a law making the orange the official state fruit of Florida. The orange blossom and orange juice were previously declared the official state flower and official state beverage. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
This is the Farming World, news and interviews from the land grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Dwayne Frederking. He's Pioneer's Technical Product Manager located in the state of Illinois. He'll talk to us a bit about agronomy and seed issues. His office is in Bloomington, but of course he's on the road today near Dalton City, Illinois. Joins us. Good afternoon to you, Mr. Frederking. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, good afternoon, Todd. Thanks for having me.
How big is the region you cover?
It's about the southern half of Illinois and southern half of Indiana.
Tell me about current conditions. Corn in the ground. A lot of the soybeans across the state, something like more than 60% are in the ground. But that means we've got here on the 19th day of May something on the a little less than half of it to plant yet. Conditions are wet and look like they're going to get wetter. Are there any problems that they'll face?
Probably the main problem that growers are dealing with now, insects starting out. Insects have been pretty quiet. A few cutworm problems here and there, but overall, insect problems are kind of few and far between. I think disease problems, mainly the seedling blights, could potentially be a problem for either the crop that's been standing underwater or been in saturated conditions for an extended period of time, or for the crops that were planted close to when the rains began and didn't get out of the ground and get established before the rains. I think this is the year we could see some pretty big differences in soybeans between the treated soybeans versus the untreated. It's something that you don't always see big differences. If we have ideal conditions or, quote, normal conditions during emergence, a lot of times the untreated beans can do just as well. But you get a wet spring like this, that's when you start to see the differences.
Now, tell me about the seed treatments for beans, what they do, because there are an awful lot of beans left to go on the ground. Is it worthwhile producers to consider a seed treatment?
I think it's something that it's kind of like insurance. And that's really what it is. If you need it, you're glad you have it. If you didn't need it, it's an investment that you put into the crop that you may end up just breaking even on or may pay for the cost of the treatment and not see any benefit from it. The main things that you're trying to protect against are some of the seedling blights, such as Pythium, Rhizoctonia, Phytophthora, some of those things that can cause damping off when the beans are emerging or shortly after emergence.
And what kind of factors do you suppose a producer ought to consider? I mean, it's a 50-50 flop, but are there risk management factors that they can consider that might give them a better idea of whether it's worthwhile? For instance, under these wet conditions, does it make a better opportunity to put a seed treatment on?
Yeah, I think the fields where the drainage is the poorest, that's where you're most likely to see the benefits. Also, the fields where you have a lot more residue, just because they're going to stay wetter and cooler for a longer period of time. So no-till fields or any heavy residue fields are likely to see more of a benefit.
Let's switch to one last topic very quickly. Fungicide applications, producers have used them sparingly in the past. They wonder about them oftentimes. Is it similar to the seed treatment? It's that it's sort of a 50-50, or is it more, are the odds better than that, that you'll need to use a fungicide and that it will actually pay for itself?
It's probably a little bit less than the 50-50 where you see the benefit, but where you see the benefit, sometimes the benefits are very large, you know, like in the double-digit yield or bushel benefits by using an insect or a fungicide rather on corn. The right answer, and I say the right answer for a number of reasons. One, just environmental stewardship. The other thing is protecting the fungicides and making sure that we have them 5 years, 10 years down the road, that we can continue to use them. But the right approach is scout fields, spray fungicides based on the presence of disease and not spraying based on any other reasons. Unfortunately, the dilemma that a lot of growers face is if they want to have the field sprayed, they need to schedule it with custom applicator well in advance, or else they just get put to the end of the list and they don't get them sprayed in time. So it's kind of a tough call for a lot of growers to make. Should they spray or should they wait and see whether the application is needed? Obviously, we can't make that decision for them, but I will reinforce again, the reason to use a fungicide is for disease prevention, disease control, and really the only way you can predict that is by scouting the fields and spraying based on that.
Mr. Frederick King, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Todd.
That is Dwayne Frederick King. He's the Pioneer Technical Product Manager located here in the state of Illinois. You're listening to, of course, The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You have a good day. If you have comments or suggestions, please do contact me at 217-333-0850 or at willagstaff@illinois.edu. That's 217-333-0850 or at willagstaff@illinois.edu.